Welcome back to another Unboxed broadcast. Today, we talk leadership with Chanel Reed, Executive Director of Family Forward Resource Center. Stick around as we help you unbox the power and the potential of your leadership.
I'm Dr. Robert Davis, family life educator and leadership coach. This is my co-host, R.P. Soriano. Soriano attended Johns Hopkins Carey Business School, worked in the financial industry, and was an international consultant before partnering with me to launch Unbox to Lead. Me? Well, I worked for over 20 years as a senior pastor and a community organizer. Then I retired and started a leader's peer support community called Unbox to Lead. Soriano and I have been friends since the early 90s, and with our varied experiences and expertise, we help leaders reach the next level in their leadership. So join us for the next few moments as we unbox the power and the potential of your relationships, your leadership, and your life.
Hello and welcome back, everyone, to another Unboxed broadcast. Let's take care of a few housekeeping matters here. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe this broadcast. And be sure to visit our website as well at www.unboxtolead.com to learn more about our peer support networks, our coaching opportunities, and also the host of webinars and courses that we offer. Today we have a special program. Today we're interviewing Chanel Reed, who I'm not seeing any longer with us. There she is. All right. Welcome back. So without any further delay, I'll turn it over to Robert and let him go ahead and kick off our conversation.
Man, I am just amped. And I think our listeners and viewers are going to get a chance to see why I am so amped. I have become a personal friend of Chanel Reed, and she is a leader of leaders. So when leaders get into a bind, and they're trying to figure out solutions, she's the one that they call, especially in the nonprofit world and the political world. And the reason that I'm so excited, and I know she's going to talk about a little bit more, is because she has been in several arenas, corporate America. She's worked in the political realm. She was the policy analyst for one of America's most famous mayors, Mayor Stephen Hogan of Aurora, Colorado. And now she's working in the nonprofit world. She is the executive director of Families Forward. She's been there since 2019. And so, like I said, she is the person who I turn to and others turn to when leaders need a leader who they can talk to and get advice from. So I'm just so excited to have her with us today. Welcome, Chanel. How you feeling?
I'm doing good for Monday. Thank you so much, Dr. D. I know I call him Dr. D, so that's his. He loves that name, and that's his name for me. So, but I'm doing good, and thank you for that introduction. It sounds too big to be me, but that's okay.
Awesome. I think everything. Well, first of all, everything I said was true, so I didn't have to embellish and I didn't have to lie. So everything I said was true. That made me feel good. And then the second thing is you have well deserved it. So let me just ask you. Let's jump right into this thing. Tell us a little bit about Families Forward, what you do, what your organization does, and any information you just want to share about your organization.
Well, Families Forward Resource Center is a full service community center. We are one of 32. Recognized resource centers in the state of Colorado. And we work on enriching families in their lives through developing partnerships. We do community health initiatives, policy advocacy, adult education, and now we're getting ready to launch an early childhood education program. We just launched it actually this week, today. With our first training session, Parents as Teachers, where parents are actually the first teacher of their children through an early learning childhood curriculum in the home. And it goes from 0 to 5 years old. And we're just really excited about this new program that we're launching. to just really get our kiddos up to par so that they can be ready to go to school. So,
you know, one of the things that I've been so I was impressed with, I think probably out of all the services that Family Forge offers, and there are a myriad of them you can just listed, is your fathering courses and your father enrichment courses, especially considering some of the challenges in the African-American community as it relates to the stabilization of families. And I think that the focus that you have put on strengthening the father is so vitally important. So I just want to say thank you for that. And so now you've told us a little bit about your leader, about the organization that you're leading. Tell us a little bit about you, the leader. Tell us a little bit about your family. How big is your family? And I'm not sure if we have you frozen. We're going to see if we have Chanel frozen, and we may have to start this whole show all over again.
I don't think so.
Yeah, she's gone.
I think we can connect it, right, Bobby?
Okay. Well, yeah, there was a good little pause in between question one and question two. So yeah, okay. That's good.
It you know, I could cut this out, but you know, it's up to you. It would disrupt the flow. Would be.
That's all right. We'll cut it.
Because remember, I was expecting her to speak some more after I talked about her fathering classes. So make a note, Bobby. After the fathering classes, I expected her to speak some more around that. And
she so we'll pick it up from there.
Yeah. So you'll cut when after I make my statements, and then when I go into her background as a leader, which will be right now.
Give me one second, Dad. I got to open my notepad.
All right. I think that was around six minutes and 15 or 20 seconds.
All right. Just can you repeat that for me, please?
Around 6 minutes and 15 seconds, somewhere around there, is probably where he started the fathering classes, or was midway through that. And then that's when he threw the question to her to talk more about that. That's when she was frozen. So we're going to go back to that question when she comes back on.
Okay, so cut to her answer. Got it.
Yeah.
Well, there is going to be no answer because I just mentioned about the fathering classes and why I was so impressed, and she didn't respond. Maybe because she
that's what I said. It would disrupt the flow when you cut things. I mean, it's very easy, but it's just
no. It won't. What it's going to seem like is that I made a mention about how appreciative I am of her fathering courses, and then I'm going to go right into the background of her as a leader.
So it'll just kind of look like a little blip.
Yeah,
that's it.
Let me call her and see what's going on.
I was going to text you. My internet just went down. It didn't go down, but I'm about to restart.
Okay, that's no problem. We're just sitting here waiting on you.
Yeah, it's me. It was me. I was like, whose internet went down? It's me.
I thought that after two questions, you got sick and tired of me. And just,
she said she'd be bold, brief, and gone.
All day, and all of a sudden, you know, the devil is alive.
I hear you. I'm going to get off this phone. I'll wait for you to come on through. We're just waiting. And don't worry about it, because we do all of our stuff post-edit, so it won't even, no one will even know. This is one of the reasons why we stopped doing stuff live, so this is perfect. Come on back.
Okay, I'll be right there.
All righty.
All right.
Bobby, you're marking when we start back, right? When she comes back on? Because I'm writing it down too, but I don't want to do it if you're doing it.
I can. I usually just look at the edit itself.
Oh, okay. You don't need to, is what you're saying.
I usually rewatch the entire podcast.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Okay, cool. Yeah.
But I can mark it down.
No, you don't have to. That's my process. It's very antiquated and probably not as efficient as yours.
Process to write down timestamps.
Hmm.
Those timestamps are godsends.
Hmm.
So, Bobby, what you'll do is you will do the initial edit. You'll drop it in the thing, as we talked about, And then Raphael will look at that edit and he will give you the timestamps for the 1 minute clips. So rather than looking, okay. Oh, let me ask you, Raphael, I'm just speaking for you. I apologize. You want to do it that way?
No, that's fine. I mean, it would, if you send me the link right after the show, I will go through and edit, but that might be a problem given this big gap here. So as long as Bobby can get it done relatively quickly and I can still do the timestamps today so that I'm just trying to make sure that everything is put in the folder when it's needed. So I don't know if...
Well, don't forget, this is not going to air until Monday because the show that's airing tomorrow is the second half of what we did last week.
Right, but when is John going to start promoting it? Isn't he going to start promoting it the week before?
Then we need to have a meeting with John. I'm not sure. I understood that the main video would show, and then the following days it would just be little recaps of the small.
Oh, that's what you want to do because he wants to kind of prep. So I don't know. We need to kind of discuss that, how that's going to go, because I know he's got
Snell's back with us.
Okay.
Her internet is on the slow side. All right, welcome back, Carter. All right, your volume is a little low again.
Oh, okay, hold on.
Is that can you give me a countdown?
Okay. When it starts. And then timestamp it, Bobby. There's a way for you to turn up the volume on your microphone in your settings. Do you know how to do that?
Let me try, because I'm using my keyboard, but let me see what's going on.
Are you on Windows?
Yes. Now,
it's a bit tricky to do it. Do you want me to share it?
It's at 100.
Okay.
That's your microphone volume or just your external speakers?
Oh, microphone. Can you hear me?
That's better, yeah.
It's just giving me, it's not letting me turn it up. I guess I have to just talk loud.
No, we can hear you very well now.
Oh, okay.
Whatever you did when you went into your sound settings, or maybe it was because you moved forward.
Maybe. I maybe need to lean in, huh? Right. Here, let me do this. Let me get rid of my keyboard because I don't need that right now. Or at least put it to the side and bring the computer. Is that better? Is that better?
That's better. I can hear you very well. Soriano? Okay.
Yes, can hear very well.
All right, okay. Bobby, we're going to go ahead and start at timestamp 1345. That gives us 14. In 4, 3, 2. All right, Chanel, tell me a little bit about your family and your family background. How big is your family?
My family on my mom's side is pretty small. We're pretty small, intimate family. My grandparents, they had two girls, 13 months apart. I'm an only child. And then I had a son, he's an only child. And my aunt and uncle, they have two sons, and between the two of them, they have five grandchildren. Yeah. So that's the extent of, you know, my family network on my mom's side. Now, my dad's side, he had 11 brothers and sisters. So I know them, but I don't really know them that intimately as far as, you know, outside of the cousins aunts and uncles that I grew up with. But my primary family, I'll say it that way, we're pretty small and we're pretty intimate.
So let me ask you, how do you think coming from a smaller family influenced you as a leader, your leadership style, et cetera?
I don't necessarily know if it was the size of the family that influenced me per se. I was really close growing up with my grandmother and grandfather. My grandfather, he was a minister. He founded a church and he pastored for 29 years before he actually retired from that. He also worked for the city of Cleveland as well as his day job. And we still have the church, and it's still our family's church. And right now, my mom and my aunt pretty much run the administration portion of that church. But we inherited a church from my granddad. And so I saw him in his leadership and how he dealt with people. I also got a chance and spent a lot of time with my grandmother, who was really the backbone of our family as far as leadership. And she taught me a lot of principles regarding, you know, being a woman. I'm the only granddaughter, and I'm the oldest. So I guess by right, I'm a leader in that generation. But she was very hard. She was much harder on the girl than she was on the boys. But yeah, she taught me a lot regarding managing time, managing a family, managing responsibilities outside of the home, such as working and also she managing finances. She was a very big influence on me when it came to financial education. So I have to give kudos to her for having those courageous conversations at the dinner table with us.
Now, as you look back on your family, can you think of any major events that influenced who you are today, how you lead today, how do you show up as a leader? Are there any major events in your family or in your personal life that you think really solidified you as a leader or helped to shape you as a leader?
Well, I would just say, you know, my grandmother, I always just remember her words of wisdom, which was, you can put off today, and today can be easy, and the rest of your life be hard, or you can put in the work today and be hard, and then the rest of your life be easy. And she showed us that and demonstrated to that effect, because I would actually in the summertime work for her. I would work for her. And so when I got to be about 12 years old, you know, I had to work in the summer for her in order to get the things I needed for school, whether it was clothes, whether it was, you know, my school supplies or things of that nature. So she taught us the value of putting in the work. And even though you are in a leadership position, you must still remain humble enough to put in the work. And so that work ethic just kind of came and grew with me throughout my childhood as well as my adult life. And everything that I did, you know, you do it in the spirit of excellence. So.
Wow. I don't know. It's as I'm listening to your story, it really does make me think about my own personal journey. My grandfather, and you mentioned your grandmother, my grandfather had such a profound impact upon my life as it just relates to how I think about leadership, how I show up and everything. So it's interesting just to hear how the various individuals in our family influence us. I think Raphael wanted to ask you about leaders and influence, but I was very concerned. I was not concerned. I was very interested in just hearing that your grandmother and her words shaped your work ethics and how you view work. Thank you.
Yeah, Chanel, it seems like that, I mean, you were very fortunate, blessed to be able to have a real life leadership mentor in your grandmother. What a great opportunity to have. Was there anyone outside of kind of that direct sphere of influence, people that were outside of that, like just anyone in society or anyone that you had observed beyond that? I mean, maybe a leader in the last 50 years or so that inspired you as well?
Yes, I've actually been blessed to have many leaders and mentors as I've gone through my career path. I started out in public administration 20 years ago at the city of Cleveland, working for a council member. His name is Bill Patman. He's now a state representative in the state of Ohio. And he was one of my first mentors. And one of the things he would always tell me to do, he asked me two poignant questions when I first started working for him. Number one, he asked me, do I know the difference between power and influence? And then he told me, always figure out what you can do and don't dwell on what you can't do. Don't ever go down the rabbit hole of what you can't do. Figure out what you can do and do that and do that well. And so those words kind of stuck with me throughout my career. And I even remind myself and I remind my staff now when they get stuck in a rut and they want to, you know, well, we can't do this and we can't do that. And I said, no, let's figure out what we can do and let's do that well. So he was one of my first mentors. He's still a leader. He's still at it. At 75 years old, he just won't give it up, but he's still at it. He's mm-hmm. still serving our community and he's in the state house. But I've been fortunate to meet leaders along the way and mentors along the way. We would be here all day and all week if I were to just tell you about leaders who have impacted my leadership over the years. You know, I have to give my hat off to Dr. Zelda Du Bois, who served the city of Aurora for 26 years as the court administrator.
Yeah.
And she was the youngest and the first court administrator that the city of Aurora had. And her words are always very impactful. And I can call her at any time in any place. And she will be there for me to answer that call. And whatever problem I have, she has a solution. She has some words of wisdom to give me. And so I love her for that. You know, Mayor Stephen D. Hogan, he was very impactful as well in my leadership. And he would always provide me with words of wisdom. And now his wife, Becky Hogan, is one of my best girlfriends. And she, too, is a force to reckon with in her own right. So, you know, I surround myself with folks that, you know, when it gets hard, I got you on speed dial. And I can pick up the phone and call them. And if I get into a dilemma, they'll steer me in the right direction.
It just jumped in my mind. And Chanel is the second leader that we've had on. I'm just kind of amazed that each leader that we speak with talks about real individuals that impacted their life. You know, when we first were developing questions to ask leaders, and this one was mentioned, I thought in my mind that they would come with, you know, Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela. And I know that we all have such respect for these great men, but I'm actually quite impressed that our leaders, and the reason I say that is because one of the things that it jumps out at me, Raphael, is just the impact that every day, not in the spotlight, not in the limelight, impact leaders have on other leaders. And I think sometimes we kind of, and I know I'm way off subject, I apologize, Chanel. I had to get this out of my system. I think sometimes that we believe that it's only the people who the books are written about that have profound impacts on people, whereas it's the people that actually touch folk that have the impact, not the ones that the books and dissertations and movies are. That's just something that jumped out of my mind. Raphael, I'm sorry. I just had to get that out of my system.
Well, I think just to further your point, and then I want to ask Chanel to expound upon something she said earlier. But I think to further your point is the infrastructure behind movements. In order to have something like, I mean, you mentioned Dr. King and other people behind the civil rights movement, for instance, you have to think about all the people and all the leaders behind that who helped to make that happen and who were leading. Actually leading the movement. We tend to focus on that one person a lot of times, but we miss all of the, I mean, even I'm amazed by that. I always hear about either an obituary or someone who's come up and you hear about their role, for instance, in the civil rights movement. And you go, wow, I never heard of them. And then you start to realize the impact that they were having. And it's just, I mean, that's just how we tend to work as a society. We tend to just prop up one leader as opposed to thinking about everyone else. And that actually is a good tie-in to what I wanted you to follow up a little bit more or expound a little bit more about, Chanel. You talked about the question that the councilman you worked for, the two questions that he asked you to consider. And the first one, knowing the difference between power and influence. Can you just talk a little bit more about that? I don't want that to slide by because that was pretty profound. Can you talk a little bit about how that value has impacted your leadership, even now, the work that you do now and the people that you work with now, whether it's working, partnering with government or the private sector or the people that you lead in your organization? How does that work for you, knowing the difference between power and influence? And give us a definition of that. Tell us what the difference is between power and influence.
Well, I don't necessarily know if I have an exact definition. And I just remember that every day when I do the work, but I also see it and I begin to live it. And it really became very profound to me when I was working at the city of Aurora. I never really had a quote unquote big title working for the city of Aurora, but everybody thought I had a big title because I sat 10 feet away from the mayor. And I worked for the mayor and city council for 11 years. I worked for three mayors and about 12 city councils in their collective body. And during my tenure, it would always interest me how council members would come to me and sit in my office and ask for advice. And I say to myself, well, you hold the title. Why are you asking me about the, you know, how to work the title? And then I saw and I saw them come and go. And I realized one day, yes, they win their elections. Yes, they hold the power stick, but a lot of times they were not influential in the work that they were trying to do. And so I realized that the influence is really what you need to make things happen. It actually gives you the ultimate quote unquote power. It's not the title, it's how you impact people on a daily basis. So you can give somebody the power stick, but if they can't move or use that power stick in a way to be impactful, they have no influence. And so I just began to utilize, you know, my influence more. And even in the nonprofit world, they didn't know me when I came in, but I was very influential. I knew a lot of people. I knew how to get things done. I knew who to call to get things done and who the movers and the shakers were. And I just began to utilize my influence in my sphere of power in order for my organization to be successful. And so now it was like an aha moment when Bill told me that. It's like, oh, okay. Fast forward 15 years later, I got the memo. And so that's primarily what it is. You can give a person a title all day long. But if they don't know how to get it done, if their influence is not there as a leader, it won't happen. it just won't get done. You're at that point, you're just managing, you're not leading.
Yeah, it reminds me of the wise counsel that a grandmother gave her granddaughter about putting in the value of putting in the work. Does that sound familiar to you? It's interesting how you connect those dots. I mean, I'm listening to you tell your story, your leadership story, and thinking about how your grandmother told you, you know, don't leave stuff for future Chanel. Handle it now. Put in the work. Leaders don't just walk around like peacocks with their feathers, you know, displayed and not actually doing the rolling up their sleeves and doing the work. So you got that message from her. And then you get this message of knowing the difference between power and influence, which is connecting to how you put in the work and how that's just impacted your leadership. And I can see why when Dr. D introduced you earlier, he introduced you as the leader that leaders come to. It all makes sense to me now. So can you talk just quickly a little bit about a personal obstacle? And I'm sure there are probably many that you've overcome in your course of leadership. But is there anything particular that was not just an obstacle, but actually had quite an impact on maybe your leadership style, or your leadership philosophy, what it did and how it is actually impacting the way you lead today? Is there anything you can kind of think of?
Yes. I think what has shaped me as the leader that I am today, when Mayor Hogan passed away in 2016, I had to think about it. I just remember, you know, his last day in the office, and when he called me to say what his diagnosis is, what his prognosis is. And he was very decisive in what he wanted to do. He was always decisive in anything that he did. And there was no changing his mind. And he basically said, I am not going to resign. I will die in office. And I need you to do X, Y, and Z. And I said, oh, okay. And so it was, again, I did not have this big title. There was a whole lot of other folks that outranked me, including my supervisor at the time, because he didn't supervise me. We just worked together, and it was my job, but he was the elected official. But protecting the seat of the mayor was very interesting when you have a mayor who says that he is not going to resign, but he wants to die in office. And so I had to protect that seat. And because everybody felt that he should have resigned, but I wanted to honor his wishes. And so that was a very tumultuous time and a trying time. And I have to give my kudos off to another one of my confidants, who's also a leader in his own right. He was the one that really kept me stable and thoughtful during that period. And that's Ryan Frazier, my little brother, as he likes to call me, his big sister. But he gave me some words of wisdom, and he's a leader in his own right. And one of the things he taught me during that period is balcony seating. You have to rise above. As a leader, you have to rise above all the chaos and the confusion that's going on around you and do some balcony seating. Get up off the floor of the theater, go up in the balcony so you can see who's all in the room and what everybody in the room is doing. And so I had to get to a place where I had to come out of the chaos and the confusion that was going on around me, and all the bickering and the talk and all the noise. And I had to rise above that occasion and come up and do some balcony seating so I could see who actually are the players in the room and what the players in the room are doing. So I utilized that even in my own leadership today, because sometimes I have to create those boundaries in order to lift the organization up. I can't always stay in the trenches with, you know, my staff, or I can't always get caught up in the political realms of some of our partners. I'm not effective there. I have to get above, because my leadership style, and I may be jumping ahead, but my leadership style is more visionary. And so I have to be able to see beyond the chaos and confusion in order to take the organization where it needs to go. And I can't get bogged down in the day-to-day stuff and start blowing to and fro with, you know, the winds of other organizations and be able to be the visionary to say, you know what, this is where we need to be in the next 6 months, in the next year, in the next 5 years. So I do a lot of balcony seating when it comes to leadership. I will take myself out of the fray. I don't apologize for it anymore. I used to always say, I'm sorry, I didn't get back to you right away. No, I'll turn that email off in a minute. But you know what? The thing about it is, so long as you're transparent, people understand. So I'll tell folks, I'll put an out of office reply on. I am working on a special project. I will get back to you when, you know, I'll get back to you next week. But you've got to come out in order to carry out that vision.
It sounds as if you have learned to put those boundaries. I think sometimes as leaders, and I'll just fess up, confession is good for the soul. So I'll confess, you know, it's very difficult when, as you said, you have that 6 month, 1 year, 5 year, et cetera, benchmarks, goals, vision that you're trying to accomplish, to say, you know what, I want to go there, but it's important for me to do me and to take care of me, which I'm about to violate every HIPAA law there is in America and talk about an experience that I know that you had, which is you were struck with a very serious medical challenge over a year ago, that had you hospitalized, and I really appreciate that you trusted me enough to be able to come in to visit you while you were hospitalized, et cetera, and going through rehabilitation. How did you manage? And because, you know, and by the way, it wasn't COVID that you had, but how did you manage those months of leading an organization during the COVID crisis, leading an organization and also trying to figure out how I deal with my own recovery and rehabilitation? And you and I had several conversations, and I've just been amazed at how you've navigated that. So let me stop talking because I want to hear from you. Talk to me a little bit about that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, and so I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm actually celebrating. This month is 1 year from my diagnosis.
And let me just say this. People who don't know you are not able to appreciate just how beautiful you look right now, just how far that you've come. You're amazing. And I'm so happy to see you and to hear you and everything. So thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. So I'm in a celebratory moment, like I said, and I'll just be transparent because, you know, that's who I am. But I was diagnosed with Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a rare neurological disease that some folks can get through. Usually it starts with a bacterial infection of the digestive system, and that's where it started with me. And it does cause, in some severe cases, it does cause paralysis. And so I had paralysis for about a month and a half and went through rehabilitation. And I actually ended up being just hospitalized and in rehab for about 3 months before I was actually released to the care of my mother. Nonetheless, they didn't let me work in the hospital, but I did have some wireless internet in the rehabilitation center. So work actually gave me a sense of normalcy during my healing process. So I checked in and I did what I can do and gave direction to my deputy, but I have to give, you know, my team much kudos because they really held me down during that time. And it was a very scary time because one of the things I had to learn is I had to trust that they can do the job without me. And as leaders, sometimes giving up that trust is one of the hardest things to do. But you have to trust your staff to do things. You don't always have to be there for them or to make the decision for them. And I always would tell them, when you grow people, you grow yourself. So through that period, they grew professionally because I had to trust them. And I also too grew as a leader because I know that I can trust them. So I now know, okay, when this vision comes along, I know who's going to ride with me and I know what you can do because you just proved it to me over the past 3 months. So, you know, it was a growth on both ends. And that's the thing. Leaders always still should be growing. And one of the things when you deposit in people, you're really depositing into yourself.
Wow, that is profound. I know that we have so much to cover, and I appreciate your patience, Raphael, because you had a series of questions, and I just get excited because
they're not relevant now.
I've just seen Chanel, how strong she stood through this. A lot of people, and no one would have blamed her had she resigned, had she just backed off, or whatever, you know, she would have chosen. But instead, she stepped up and provided leadership. And I like what you said about how it was part of the healing process for you to continue to engage, but also to go through the steps of empowering your team. I thought that was really insightful and educational. Thank you.
And mind you, we were in the middle of a construction project.
I just thought about the pandemic. I forgot you're in the middle of a major construction project. You're dealing with your own illnesses. You're expanding because at that time you had just taken on several new services that your organization was beginning to provide. Wow. There was all the perfect storm, and then then the perfect way to navigate through that storm. Okay, I'm done, Raphael. I promise.
I was just gonna say, dealing with contractors and construction during a major illness, I don't do it.
It's enough to drive you crazy when everything is just normal. So I can imagine.
Don't do it.
Yeah, that's a big challenge. Listening to your story, Chanel, it's motivational, it's inspiring, it's a real testament to just everything that makes you you. I've really enjoyed just sitting here listening to you just kind of go through your history, especially with your grandparents, your parents, and then all of the experiences along the way. It's just interesting. It's like watching a movie. I can see how it all connects to make you who you are today. And you brought up some really good points, things that we talk about here on our broadcast a lot. And it's like dealing with overfunctioning, not doing everything for your team, trusting them to have the skills, the ability to be able to, you know, execute the vision that you've laid out. It also sounds like your leadership philosophy as being visionary is also a way of just kind of managing anxiety as well, and not always being in the trenches when you don't necessarily need to be there. So, I mean, you've brought out so many things that I think are very important for leaders. But is there and I'm sure there probably is, but what's the kind of advice that you would give? You know, I'm coming to you as a relatively new leader, whether in the nonprofit space, hypothetically speaking, or in the political arena. And I want to be a leader, or I'm in the process of that. What's the advice that I get from Chanel when we go out for coffee or we sit down and have a salad together? What is it that, how do you grab me by the collar and say, listen, Soriano, this is what you need to do in order to be a great leader like myself? Because that's why I'm talking to you, because I'm wanting to be like you. So fire away. Give me the advice.
Well, first and foremost, learn to listen.
All right, I'm out. That's it. I'm done. Show's over. Because if I do that, I might stay married for another year. All right, learn to listen. Okay, go ahead. Learn to listen.
Listen. Know when to lead and then also know when to be a team member and allow others to lead. And then when you allow others to lead, back them up and support them. You don't, as a leader, another thing, and this actually just came to me today, a leader doesn't have to prove themselves to the people they're leading. The people they're leading has to prove themselves to the leader.
Talk about that a little bit.
So oftentimes, as a leader, you know, you have folks who are upcoming leaders and you want to support them and you want to give them, you know, an open floor to be expressed, you know, to express their opinions and their concerns and their comments. And you have to, as a leader, you have to be open to that. But you also have to be open to when they challenge your leadership. And when you're giving guidance and as a leader, when you give guidance and wisdom, we understand the difference. They may not understand. They may be just having some short-sightedness. So you allow them to have that short-sightedness at that moment. But then when it actually happens, you give them enough room to have it that they don't really do any damage, but they can just go out and understand that you was a little short-sighted in this particular situation. And what I was really telling you was for your own good. It's almost like a parent-child relationship, but I don't want to dumb it down to that, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you give them the leeway to go out and, okay, you go out. I didn't give you the wisdom. You go out and figure it out. But eventually they'll come back because what you told them was actually wisdom for their own good, but they have to go see it. But you also have to give that room to do so. So that's when I say, you know, you can't take it personal. Just throw that wisdom out there. Let them do what they need to do to a point where they can't damage themselves or others, because eventually they'll come back. They'll come back.
Yeah. And I'm hearing a lot, Raphael, I'm hearing an awful lot about the need. And it seems like this is kind of like something that undergirds your leadership philosophy and style. That need to trust your team. Mm-hmm. And I want to just stick with this theme of trust for a little bit and kind of do a master class here. If I can jump in here with this master class. You were in a unique situation when you took over Families Forward. Families Forward was not an organization that you started or founded. It was already up and running. They already had their board. You already had a team that was in place. And so often when you come in as a leader to a team that is already in place, that is already has a system and how they function, et cetera, it can be extremely challenging. And so even though when we talked about this and when you and I talked about this initially, I was going to just kind of keep it broad, but I really think that we have leaders who are watching this who are assuming responsibilities and they're coming in, especially if you're following someone who was very popular and well-liked, and now you're having to replace them, and people kind of became accustomed to their leadership style, et cetera. Talk to me a little bit about how you've navigated that. I want to talk a little bit about some of the resistance that you may have experienced And then I want to talk about how you navigate that, how you were able to stand firm. So let's talk about that. How was that experience with you?
Rough.
In a word, as the old dog said, rough, rough.
Rough. You're right. I mean, I came into an organization where, well, let me back up. I am the third executive director this organization's had in its 20 plus years of existence. And when I came into the organization, I inherited a lot. Some good, some bad. And I was challenged to take it to a whole nother level. I inherited a lot of debt. I inherited staff that had been there since the existence of the organization. I had some staff that this was their only job that they've had in their adult life. And everybody wanted to tell me how they did things. And so I did receive a lot of resistance initially. A lot of staff left. I had to actually get the organization out of debt, which we did very successfully by 2020. So my first 18 months, we were able to get out of debt. And even still moving forward, you know, I still have a considerable amount of resistance. But I navigate that through, again, not having to prove myself as a leader, but you proving to me why I should trust you and to lead. Because everybody that was there when the organization went into debt. So why should I listen to you? I'm just saying.
Yeah.
But you can't just put it out there like that, because you just can't step on people's hearts. Because one of the things I know my staff is, they're very passionate about this organization and they're very passionate about the work that they do. So let's turn this passion into something that's positive. And just now, just really now trying to just change the culture of how we do things, because maybe things do need to be a little bit more structured. You know, it's funny when people, they always want flexibility and autonomy, but they really don't want flexibility and autonomy. They want some direction. They want some guidance. They want some form of structure to give them discipline. So having those kind of conversations with staff to really figure out what is it that you really want, and then bringing on new staff, bringing on new board members to give a different perspective. That
before you go into that, I want to just jump in just for a second here, because one of the things you talk about, bringing on new board members, bringing on new team members, losing team members can have such an emotional impact on the organization. So when Jane Doe leaves, Sally Sue and Mary Lee, they internalize it because they had such a strong relationship with Jane Doe. And now you're experiencing some of their emotional pushback. Plus, you're also losing individuals who are competent at their particular job. How does a leader, and I'm really specifically asking, how did you navigate those relationship and emotional dynamics that take place when individuals realize that they're not a good fit for the organization and they begin to transition out, or when you have to assist them in transitioning out? How did you manage that emotionality? How did you manage those relationships?
So you said a key word. Transitioning. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I had to do for us to move forward as a team is I had to transition or pivot from one leadership, from one leader to another, I realized that the organization and the people within the organization were still in mourning and they were still grieving. And I had to be sensitive to that. Mm. And so I read a book called Managing Transitions or Transitioning, How to Manage Change or something like that. But it was about transitioning. And one of the things it recommended to do is to have a funeral. To have a funeral of within the organization and celebrate the death of one thing and at the same time celebrate the birth of another. So you recognize the grief, you recognize it, you celebrate it, you let them mourn it, but then you also have to say, but we're birthing something over here.
Yeah.
Now, what ended up happening, and I don't always recommend this for organizations unless you are financially able to do it, but we were blessed to be financially able to do it. One of the things that changed the trajectory of where we are going as an organization is I moved the office. Okay. So long as they were in that same office space where the previous leader was, they mourned. Once I changed their location, we had our grieving process, we honor it, but it sparked them into the future. And so at the end of the day, you can't just roll over it as a leader and say, well, their feelings aren't real. You have to honor that. And you have to give
the feelings of your team.
And having that grieving moment, whether it's, you know, sometimes, and I've heard of folks that just went and just did a whole funeral.
Yeah.
Just to get it out. But you got to get it out. You got to bury it. And then you got to birth. And so once we got into the birthing cycle, I'm like, guys and ladies, we're going to grieve this because we birthing over here. Yeah. So honoring their
new
feelings.
Projects, new programs, new building, new leadership, new opportunities, new communities, new collaborations. Hey, I love that. And I resonate with that because my name is Robert Lee. I'm named after my grandfather. My brother is John C. Davis IV. So, of course, you got to go back three generations. He's named after my great-grandfather, John Davis Sr. But I believe that, as you said, that grieving of the loss and allowing our teams and acknowledging and walking with them through the grieving process and then celebrating the birth, that to me is very profound. Thank you.
I think if I could interject here, I think listening to the way that you handled this, Chanel, I think it speaks to one of the challenges that a lot of people may have with leaders, and that is feeling like the leader doesn't care or that the leader doesn't quite get the fully understand the frustrations and the challenges that the team is having, which would include whatever is happening in the operations piece, but also in the emotional realm of work. I can think of a lot of times when the morale of an organization pivots or hinges on whether or not the organization feels that the leader actually cares and can resonate. Doesn't necessarily have to always change things. But like you said, acknowledge that, hey, there is mourning here. There is a loss. I get it. I see it. I hear you. And this is the way that I'm going to guide us through that as a leader. This is the way I'm going to. You may not like it. You may not agree with all of the steps that I'm taking. But you do know you can always end the day and start the day with the feeling, well, at least the person leading us gets it. I may not agree with everything. I'll sign on for it. I'll get on board. At least they get it. And I think that a lot of leaders really, really hamstring themselves by kind of, you know, barricading themselves up or dying on a hill that they don't necessarily need to die on by saying, hey, I'm the one who's in charge here. We're going to do it my way. I don't really care how you're feeling about it. Just do it. Which is, you talked about it earlier about that parenting process. That's kind of been what I've been known for and famous in my parenting, which caused me all kinds of sorrow and pain. But once my kids realize that I do understand what's going on, it changes the entire dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's, you know, just giving them, going back to just really acknowledging that there is pain and don't just roll over it. Like it doesn't really matter, because I know what Kathy Hill Young meant to all of them. And so I can't just roll over it, but let's collectively find a way to honor and celebrate it.
You know, you're speaking to something too that I want to kind of highlight. You said that as you took on this role, you read a book, and the book that you read gave you some insight into how to acknowledge and manage that. Do you think that a lot of leaders just will not recognize those feelings because they just don't have the skill or even know that that's an issue in the first place, or is it just sheer stubbornness or a sense that they'll think that the leader is weak by acknowledging it, or some combination of all of that?
It probably is a combination of all of it. It just depends on, you know, that person's leadership style. And then it also depends on what they're dealing with. You know, oftentimes when you take over a new organization, at least my experience, when I took over the organization, I was overwhelmed by the things that I was asked to tackle. And it's like, well, what do I do first? You know? And so I've gotten to a place now where I take everything in stride. I pace myself. And so every morning I get up and I put together my list of 3 to 5 things I want to accomplish today. And when I can accomplish my list, then I feel accomplished. Now, my list might not be your list. And I tell my staff that, you know, my list of priorities might not be your list of priorities of what you think should be done. Now, I also tell them procrastination on your part does not constitute an emergency on mine. So long as I can accomplish my list, then we day by day we'll work through and everything else will get done. But don't expect my list to match yours, because it's not. Let's have that understanding and let's be clear. Now we can talk through it. But I have to work through my own process and step by step. And then when it gets to be too much, that's when you get the out of office reply that I am working on a special project.
I think that's a good place to leave it. A wise leader once told me a long time ago, probably about 45 minutes ago, that one of her philosophies is to be brief, be bold, and be gone. So I think we're gonna take that advice and we're gonna leave it here. I could listen to you and have a conversation with you for hours, Chanel. This has really, really been a great experience, and we're honored. I mean, just honored to have been able to have had you on and to be able to kind of just sit at the table and to listen to you talk about your experiences and how you lead your organization and the things that make you the experiences that have made you the leader that you are. Thank you so much for sharing that with us and with our listeners.
Thank you for having me. This was fun. This great conversation.
All right. So that will wrap up our show for Dr. Robert Davis. I'm R.P. Soriano. And once again, we thank you all for joining us here. Be sure to visit our website once again at www.unboxedtolead.com to learn more about what we do and to also to be able to access the broadcast that we have done in the past. Thank you once again.
Unbox provides a full-service leaders peer support community that helps high-level leaders become more authentic leaders who build healthy workplace cultures and reach their personal life goals. To learn more and discover how we can take your leadership and your life to the next level, please visit our website at unboxedtolead.com. That's unboxed, the number two, lead.com. Again, that's unboxed, the number two, to lead.com.